it's the two shows that we did yesterday. Those of you who might follow, I made a short presentation yesterday of the different institutions and how to search for documents there. I kind of, not skipped, but rushed through the commission, which of course you shouldn't do if you really want to go into the deep core of the EU. And one of the people who has done that, not rushed through, but really gone into the commission, is Olivier, who works with this Corporate Europe Observatory. I'm sure you are aware of. If not, Olivier will surely tell you a bit about his organization. I've asked him, asked him to come here because it's interesting to see how this NGO or a civic organization, or how you would like to define it, what tools do they use in order to get their facts and to get their the contents that they want to reach. And as journalists, I think we work quite closely, and I'm a bit curious to see how you go to it and if that differs very much from how journalists work. I know the outcome of your work has been very amazing, only to say maybe you will have some good examples yourself, but for example, the Ombudsman has taken a good look at Mario Draghi, the chairman of the European Central Bank, as Corporate Europe Observatory found out that he was part of this rather influential group called Group 30, with bankers of a different kind. So that's just one, and maybe not the best example, but Olivier will surely tell you more about that. So I'm pleased you're here, and the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm indeed Olivier Hoedeman, and I'm the Research and Campaign Coordinator at Corporate Europe Observatory. We are an NGO, not a media organization, and we do a lot of research focusing on the role of industry lobbying, particularly in the EU's decision-making. That's our specific focus or niche. And as an NGO, we're also campaigning. We're campaigning for better transparency and ethics and accountability rules for the EU institutions, particularly the European Commission and the European Parliament. And in this this workshop, we're focusing on freedom of information requests. And this is indeed for CEO, it's one of the standard tools that we use in most of the research projects that we undertake. It's part of the toolbox that we use most often. And I will share with you some examples of how we've done that, just a few examples, but it's really something we've done since we started in 1997, 15 years ago, and particularly our focus has been strongly on the European Commission, so I think there will be some insights to share on how to use access to documents legislation, use that as a tool to open up the hidden part of how decisions are made by the European Commission. I have a handout that I didn't manage to print out, but I can send to you an email which has a lot of the basics of how to use the freedom of information possibilities. And I will not in this presentation go very deep into that. And we heard indeed from Stefan yesterday some very important essentials of how it works. I will focus more on experiences in practice, and I think it's definitely fair to say that the EU regulation for access to documents is on paper very strong. It gives a lot of possibilities, and in practice it is less ideal than what you could expect. So in practice, what we see is that the European Commission interprets the rules, and it might not surprise you, I guess it happens at governments everywhere. They interpret the rules in the most often in the most narrow way possible, and try to undermine access. And we are suffering in almost every week, as we do, with serious delays far beyond the official 15 working days. and so on. That is the general picture. And I should say, I think that is probably the case not only for Corporate Europe Observatory. I should add that we know that the European Commission in some cases looks at the request for documents and analyzes whether it's politically convenient to release it and whether it's convenient to give it to Corporate Europe Observatory. 10 years ago, we received a brown document and without a lot of information on it, but inside there was there was some internal commission correspondence from the trade department of the commission. It included a response to an access to document request that we had filed, but it also included the internal commission correspondence about how to handle that request. And it said explicitly, the official in charge, that this organization is politically not a friend of the commission and we should be restrictive in what we give them. So since then we know that at least that department has an approach that is not completely according to the rules. Now, typical requests that we do when we try to reconstruct the influence of lobby groups or lobbyists on a commission decision is to ask for a list of meetings, for minutes and other reports of meetings, correspondence, and other information. This is very typical, just in general. And sometimes we get in the list of meetings. Here's what sometimes happens. This happens less than in the past. This was very typical 5 or 10 years ago, that major parts of the documents that we received would be blacked out in this way. With reference to commercial secrets, to not endangering ongoing international negotiations, and many other arguments. This was not an uncommon response to get.
Short question before you go further. You put out the link to the electronic forms there. Do you use the forms on the net, or do you just email them, or have you noticed any difference in how?
Yes, I think I'll come to that
okay,
in a second.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'll come to that. That's an important question. But more recently, I just wanted to show, this is a more common type of response. Instead of blacking out, there is between brackets some sentence deleted. It looks less provoking or less secretive. And here, you could, 20 words deleted, 21 words deleted, and so on. So it's still, it's the same thing, but it looks less problematic.
I doubt that it is the same thing. I have some problems with what do they send you? Normally they should send you what they send to the others if the communication. And here they send you Word files, and you never know if it's the final version or not.
No, that's true.
So I really prefer to have the TIFF copies of the sent document, and
absolutely.
That's essentially what we ask.
Yeah.
So in a way, that's already breaking the law.
That's right. Here they have actually created a new document in the center, so this is indeed problematic. Yeah. And I think also that. Very true that this is much clearer. Yeah. Okay. So, yes. I will go into a couple of examples and we'll introduce some of the ways we work in practice. Starting with one of the ways we've used freedom of information law of the EU quite effectively, I think, is to throw light on the European Commission's expert groups. These are the advisory groups that the Commission uses in the very first stage of decision making. So of course the Commission has the monopoly on proposing new laws. It's the only EU institution that has the right of initiative. And in that very first stage, the Commission relies often quite heavily on these advisory groups that are referred to as expert groups. There are about 1,000 such groups at the moment. If we go back 7-8 years ago, very little was known about these groups. And today, due to the work of some MEPs and also of NGOs, much more is known. And I want to zoom in on. Let's see. Just one example here. Weakness here in my Yes. Okay. So in 2009, what we did, 2008 and 2009, we started looking into the role of the Commission's advisory groups in shaping financial market regulation. This was a year or two after the financial crisis erupted, and it had become clear that EU legislation for regulation of financial markets was not exactly what it should have been to prevent this huge bubble and the destabilizing impacts that we saw on the economy. And together with a number of other NGOs, we set up a very large research project that tried to reconstruct which advisory groups had been involved in shaping that legislation in the 5 to 10 years before, who the members of those advisory groups were, tried to get hold of documents from meetings, and so on and so on. And we published a 25-page report that documented that these advisory groups of the part of the Commission shaping that legislation were heavily dominated by the financial services industry. So the people that were invited to provide advice were people with a conflict of interest who were perhaps experts, but who were representing the interest of the industry itself. This was done with the help of the European Commission's Register for Expert Groups, which already existed at the time, but which had very limited information in it on many of the groups that existed. So we used freedom of information rules, and that was very hard work over a long period of time to throw light on the membership of these groups. And we included a number of case studies, for example, one on the way the Commission prepared its savings directive, which is a piece of legislation that covers measures against tax evasion. And the expert group on that issue, which is called the EU Savings Directive Expert Group, was full of people, representing companies and lobby groups with an interest in not regulating against tax havens and tax evasion. That's an example of what was uncovered in this piece of research. The first reaction from the Commission to these findings was that it was normal to have the banking sector closely involved. They said, you don't ask a baker for advice on banking. But soon after, the responsible commissioner, which is Michel Barnier, he took a different line. He found indeed that these problems were unacceptable. He stated that it had led to a form of regulatory capture of the Commission's decision-making, and he instructed his officials to make sure that the composition of these groups, that these problems would not be repeated, that they would become more balanced. And this was also due to work from members of the European Parliament, but I think this research, together with the Auto EU coalition, really really helps in that respect.
Do you have a question?
Yes.
A small question on these advisory groups. Do they get paid with the European money, or is it external bodies?
They are not commissioner. There are commission officials involved, there are member states officials involved, and then there are external experts who can be academics, but in this case it tended to be people on the payroll of the financial sector. Typically they would receive travel reimbursement hotel paid, and some people were also receiving a per diem. But so there is a budget for this whole expert group system, but it's not that they are people really receiving salary now. Mm-hmm. And for this research, we used simple requests by email that we sent to the European Commission. Yeah. And all right. So I want to continue with the next example, which is around EU trade policy. We've been working on that issue for a long time, different international trade negotiations that the EU was involved in, and how the European Commission shaped its negotiating goals and negotiating strategies. And for many of these negotiating processes, we had, through access to documents requests, we had uncovered a very close partnership between the Commission's Trade Department and industry lobby groups, a partnership in shaping the list of demands from the EU side to the countries that they negotiate with, but also during the negotiations, industry helping the Commission put pressure on people in the other countries. In 2009, we started with a project focusing on the EU-India talks, which were about to start at that time. In the opening session yesterday, there was a reference to that because this was a research project that then ended with a court case. We took the European Commission to court because of their discrimination in the way they provide access to documents to the industry side and to anyone else who would ask for the same documents would be rejected. And I just want to show you an example of what that looks like here. Okay. So we had found out that the European Commission was sharing a lot of sensitive documents with industry lobby groups, particularly Business Europe and the European Services Forum, but also others. The same documents, when we would ask for them, or if any of you would ask for them, would be rejected and labeled as confidential, and the disclosure would endanger the EU's international relations and the interest in those negotiations. And so we took that through the whole procedure of access to documents, requests, appeal, confirmatory appeal, and so on. And found 17 documents, of which we knew that industry had received them, and we have been denied access with unconvincing reasons. And just to show you one example, let me see. Oh. Okay. Yes. Okay. So here, this is from a letter from Peter Mandelson to one of the industry lobby groups, Business Europe, in which he, with a handwritten note, asked them if they can raise the issues that he had brought up in the letter with their counterparts in India. So the European Commission was using Business Europe as a partner in those talks, and the documents reflected that. So this was something that was not blacked out and not rejected, but it showed this very cozy relationship, and it was something we could use to argue that it was a case of discrimination in access to documents as well.
Could you say what you might take?
You might take some comments to your counterparts in the Confederation of Indian Industry in view of the above. That's what Mandelson wrote. And this is just one example. There were got quite a few documents of this kind. So that's that court case, we expect a ruling in June, and I think we'll maybe discuss that a bit later, but for us that's a very important test case, and it could have pretty far-reaching positive repercussions if we win. Yeah.
And you can have a question. Have you published about this?
Yes. Yes, yeah. We have put out press releases and so on. It has not been picked up very widely in Britain. That's
May I follow that up on this?
Yes, of course. Yeah, yes. All of these documents I can put together in an email for you, so it's
great.
Easier to. Yeah. Yes. Okay. The access to documents request in this case we also simply used. We submitted them through emails. Recently, we have started using the Ask the EU website quite intensively. Oh. Yesterday, Stefan introduced that. Also, the dilemmas that are there. If you use this website, it's very convenient. You can submit your requests online. You get a lot of... you can choose the institution, for example. You get the email address is then automatically selected for you. And you get reminders when the deadlines are up and these kind of things. Very convenient. The disadvantage that Stefan mentioned yesterday is that it's in the public domain, so others will know that you are looking into the case. for us, that's generally not a problem, quite the opposite, because the European Commission then also knows that others are watching their responses. So what we did a couple of weeks ago, there are EU-US free trade talks on the way. Negotiations will be launched in June. There's a lot of very sensitive issues that are likely to be covered in there, ranging from data privacy to GMOs and so on. So we were interested in seeing how the Commission has consulted with industry on those talks. So we submitted an access to documents request through Ask the EU, and then also announced on Twitter that we had done so, and that tweet was retweeted by a lot of interested groups and so on. And the European Commission will have noticed that most likely, and it is it's my experience that that can lead to a faster response, avoiding delays, because it's out in the open. And on this request, just to mention, the first response we got was that meetings with industry and correspondence with industry, the Commission considers that to be an excessively large request. I should say that it's only from January 2012 that we asked for, and asked us to narrow down the request. This is something you will very often run into, and we simply argued against the use of that paragraph in the Freedom of Information Law, where they can, which the Commission can refer to, if it indeed does entail a very large number of documents. And we asked for a list of the meetings and of the documents, so we can assess whether it's really a very large number, and whether delay is justified or not. So I think that's a very important piece of advice. Delays are very, very likely, and it's very important to be fast with responding to the Commission, and be aware that there is a tendency to try to narrow down your request and to delay the responses, especially on politically sensitive issues. On this one, the talks start in June. The Commission has a clear interest in not getting any documents in the released for June. So, and of course, we have the other interests.
Would it make sense to make an effort to highlight this delay and two massive request tactics of the Commission somehow, and to make a complaint specifically about that to the Ombudsman, who also contributes to these delays, because he generally gives very often and frequently extra delays for the Commission to answer, and in the end, when the Commission gives out some documents, he closes the case being satisfied without ever raising the issue of the delay. In a way, a document delayed is a document denied, you could in a lot of cases say, especially for journalists, I suppose, because they can't keep the story on hold for eternity.
Yeah.
So do you see any way of highlighting that? Okay.
Yes, we have a few times gone to the Ombudsman, indeed, with complaints about delays, and that has not really been too effective, indeed, the mechanism of complaining to the Ombudsman about that. And also, I mean, I will say a lot of positive things about the Ombudsman in a moment, but there are indeed cases where you can be disappointed, and one of the reasons that we took the Commission to court over the EU-India talks and this problem that I described was that we were not getting anywhere through Ombudsman complaints. We've done quite a few.
The court also completely ignores the fact of time.
Yes, that could be,
That's the experience I have, because there even it's worse, because if you go to the court, you always might face a situation that during your court case, the Commission issues a new reply to you.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't extend your court case to that or take back your court case, you will lose it.